the author and director of a ponderous fiasco. Henry Ward Beecher was saying of him from a pulpit in Brooklyn, "Not a spark of genius has he, not an element for leadership, not one particle of heroic enthusiasm." Wendell Phillips thought him something worse and said so from a Boston lecture platform. "He may be honest. Nobody cares whether the tortoise is honest or not. He has neither insight, nor prevision, nor decision. As long as you keep the present turtle at the head of the government, you make a pit with one hand and fill it with the other." The politicians were in full bay, particularly those of his own party who had been urging, without success, his support of anti-slavery legislation, which he feared would lose him the border states, held to the Union so far by his promise that no such laws would be passed. It also seemed to these Republicans that entirely too many Democrats were seated in high places, specifically in the cabinet and the army. And now their anger was increased by apprehension. About to open their campaigns for re-election in November, they had counted on battlefield victories to increase their prospects for victory at the polls. Instead, the main Eastern Army, under the Democrat McClellan, McNapoleon they called him, had held back as if on purpose and then retreated to the James, complaining within hearing of the voters that the administration was to blame. Privately, many of the Jacobins agreed with the charge, though for different reasons, the main one being that Lincoln, irresolute by nature, had surrounded himself with weak-spined members of the opposition party. Fessenden of Maine put it plainest. "The simple truth is, there was never such a shambling half-and-half set of incapables collected in one government since the world began." The people themselves were disconsolate. "Give me a victory and I will give you a poem," James Russell Lowell wrote his publisher. "But I am now clear down in the bottom of the well where I see the truth too near to make verses of." Apparently the people shared his gloom. Their present reaction was nothing like the short-lived panic they had staged 5 weeks ago, when Stonewall Jackson broke through to the line of the Potomac. Nor was it characterized by aroused determination, as in the period following Bull Run the year before. It was, in fact, strangely apathetic and difficult to measure, even for a man who had spent a lifetime with one hand on the public pulse, matching the tempo of his actions to its beat. Lincoln watched and wondered. One indication was the stock market, which broke badly under the impact of the news from the peninsula. Another was the premium on the gold in the Union dollar, which had stood at 3.5% a month ago, but since then had risen to 17%. He watched and wondered, unable to catch the beat. In response to McClellan's call for reinforcements on the day of Malvern Hill, "I need 50,000 more men, and with them I will retrieve our fortunes," Lincoln told him, "Maintain your ground if you can, but save the army at all events, even if you fall back to Fort Monroe. We still have strength enough in the country, and we'll bring it out." Well, McClellan had saved the army, and the strength enough was there, but Lincoln was uncertain as to how to bring it out. The present apathy might be a lull before the storm that would be brought on by another call for troops. As he phrased it, "I would publicly appeal to the country for this new force, were it not that I fear a general panic and stampede would follow. So hard is it to have a thing understood as it really is." As usual, he found a way. To call for troops was one thing, to receive them was another. Seward was sent to New York to confer with men of political and financial power, explain the situation, and arrange for the northern governors to urge the president to issue a call for volunteers to follow up the recent successes of the federal arms. Lest there be any doubt as to whether the administration intended to fight this war through to a finish, Seward took with him a letter. "I expect to maintain this contest until successful, or till I die, or am conquered, or my term expires, or Congress or the country forsake me. Yours very truly, A. Lincoln." 17 governors, plus the president of the Military Board of Kentucky, responded promptly by affixing their signatures to a communication written by Seward, addressed to the chief executive, and saying in part, "We respectfully request, if it meets with your entire approval, that you at once call upon the several states for such number of men as may be required to garrison and hold all of the numerous cities and military positions that have been captured by our armies, and to speedily crush the rebellion that still exists in several of the southern states, thus practically restoring to the civilized world our great and good government." Being thus urged, Lincoln took his cue and, in early July, fully concurring in the wisdom of the views expressed to me in so patriotic a manner, issued a call for 300,000 volunteers. In fact, so entirely did the request meet with his approval, he followed this first call with another 1 month later for 300,000 more. Lowell, clear down in the bottom of the well, had said he could produce no poem unless he received a victory as payment in advance. But lesser talents apparently required a lesser fee. J.S. Gibbons found in this second call a subject fit for his muse, and Stephen Foster set the result to music. "If you look up all our valleys where the growing harvests shine, you may see our sturdy farmer boys fast forming into line. And children from their mothers' knees are pulling at the weeds and learning how to reap and sow against their country's needs. And a farewell group stands weeping at every cottage door. We are coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more." Reinforcements would be welcome all along the line. There was scarcely a mile of it that did not have some general calling plaintively or angrily for more soldiers. But more soldiers, even 500,000 of them, would not solve the basic problem, which was one of high command. For 4 months now, ever since the abrupt relief of McClellan back in March, the overall conduct of the war had been directed by Lincoln and Stanton, a sort of two-headed, four-thumbed amateur, with results just short of disastrous in the theater which had received their main attention. Stonewall Jackson, for example, had frightened Stanton and decoyed Lincoln into breaking up the combinations McClellan had designed for taking Richmond, so that Davis and Lee, professionals both, had been able to turn the tables on the Army of the Potomac, effecting counter-combinations that drove it headlong to the James. Part of the fault could be assigned to flaws that developed in subordinate commanders. On the one hand, Fremont's ineptness, on the other, McClellan's lack of aggressive instincts, but most of it lay with the overall direction, which had permitted the enemy to bring pressure on those flaws. Lincoln could see this now in retrospect, much of it, at any rate, and in fact he had begun to suspect it soon after the failure of his chessboard combinations in the valley. In his distress, before the blow fell on the peninsula, his mind turned back to Winfield Scott, the one general who had shown thus far that he really knew what war was all about. The old man was in retirement up the Hudson at West Point, too infirm for travel. So on June 23rd, a Monday, the first of the 7 days was 2 days off, Lincoln boarded a special train and rode north to see him. What they talked about was a secret, and it remained so. But when McClellan wired the War Department on June 27th, while Porter was under attack on Turkey Hill, "I will beg that you put some one general in command of the Shenandoah and of all troops in front of Washington for the sake of the country, secure unity of action and bring the best men forward," Lincoln, who had returned 2 days before, had already done what he suggested even before his visit up the Hudson. That is, he had united the troops under one commander. Whether he had brought the best man forward remained to be seen. John Pope was the man. Halleck had praised him so highly he had lost him. Indeed, for months now, the news from that direction had seemed to indicate that the formula for victory, so elusive here on the seaboard, had been discovered by the generals in the West. In which case, as Lincoln and Stanton saw it, the thing to do was bring one of them east and give him a chance to apply it. Grant's record having been tarnished by Shiloh and the subsequent rumors of negligence and whiskey, Pope was the more or less obvious choice, not only because of Island 10 and Halleck's praise of his aggressiveness during the campaign against Corinth, but also because Lincoln, as a prairie lawyer pleading cases in Pope's father's district court, had known him back in Illinois. There were objections. Montgomery Blair, for instance, warned that old Judge Pope was a flatterer, a deceiver, a liar, and a trickster. All the popes are so. But the president could not see that these were necessarily drawback characteristics in a military man. While admitting the general's infirmity when it came to walking the chalk line of truth, he protested that a liar might be brave and have skill as an officer. Also, perhaps as a result of a belief in the Westerner's ability to combine effectively the several family traits Blair had warned of, he credited him with great cunning, a quality Lincoln had learned to prize highly as a result of his brush with Stonewall Jackson in the Valley. So Pope was sent for. Arriving while Lincoln was up the country seeing Scott, he made at once an excellent impression on Stanton and the members of the Committee on the Conduct of the War, who saw in him the antithesis of McClellan. For one thing, there was nothing of caution about him. He was a talker, and his favorite words were "I" and "forward." If he had been placed in charge of the West in the early spring, he said, nothing could have stopped his march on New Orleans. By now he would have split the South in two and gone to work on the crippled halves. For another, he was sound on the slavery question, assuring the committee that he and it saw eye to eye on the matter. Wade and the others were delighted not only with his opinions, civil as well as military, but also with his appearance, which they found as reassuring as his beliefs. He had shaved his cheeks and his upper lip, retaining a spade-shaped chin beard that bobbed and wagged decisively as he spoke, lending weight and point to his utterances and increasing the overall impression of forcefulness and vigor. Lincoln, when he returned from the visit with Scott, was pleased to see the confidence Pope had managed to invite within so brief a span, and gave him at once his orders and his assignment to the command of an army expressly created for his use. The Army of Virginia, it was called. Its strength was 56,000 men, and its mission was to move in general down the line of the Orange and Alexandria Railroad, just east of the Blue Ridge Mountains, so as to close in on the Confederate capital from the west and north, while McClellan's Army of the Potomac applied pressure from the east. Thus Richmond would be crushed in a giant nutcracker, with Pope as the upper jaw. His army was created by consolidating the commands of McDowell, Banks, and Fremont. All three of these generals outranked him, an unusual arrangement, to say the least. But only one of them took official umbrage. This was Fremont, which solved another problem. His protest resignation was accepted, and Lincoln replaced him with Franz Sigel, whose appointment, though it involved a 1,000-mile transfer, was considered especially felicitous since so many of the troops involved were of German extraction. Pope's instructions, issued June 26th as part of the order creating his army, required him to operate so as to protect Washington from danger or insult and to render the most effective aid to relieve General McClellan and capture Richmond. It was a large order, but Pope only laid down one condition. McClellan must be given peremptory orders to attack the minute he heard that Pope was engaged. This was necessary, Pope said, because of the known timidity and irresolution of his partner in the squeeze play. For the present, however, as he learned all too soon, the stipulation was unnecessary. On the day the Army of Virginia came officially into being, McClellan no longer had any choice in the matter. The 7 days had opened, and the Army of the Potomac found itself engaged in a tremendous struggle for survival, trying first to fend off Lee's assault down the north bank of the Chickahominy, and then to reach the gunboat sanctuary of the James. When news of the attack reached Washington, Pope showed that there were elements of caution in his makeup after all. He advised Lincoln not to let McClellan fall back southward, since this would unhinge the jaws of the Nutcracker, but to order him to retire in the direction of the York. That way, Pope said, he could eventually go to his assistance, and vice versa, in case the Army of Virginia ran into similar trouble moving south. But there was nothing Lincoln could do about it, even if he had wanted to. The wires were cut, and the Army of the Potomac was already in motion for the James. Pope began to see the handwriting on the wall. It warned him plainly that there was an excellent chance that he would be entirely on his own as he moved down the road that led to Richmond. Discouraging as this prospect was to the newly arrived commander, a look into the backgrounds of the three groups he was expected to weld into an effective striking force proved equally discouraging, if not more so. Two of the three, Banks's and Sigel's, had traditions of defeat, and the third, McDowell's, had slogged all over northern Virginia, seemingly without profit to anyone, least of all to itself. Unquestionably, even in their own eyes, Milroy's weary boys were a case in point. This was the second team, restricted to an occasional scrimmage, which served primarily to emphasize its lack of style, while the first team got the cheers and glory on the peninsula. For all his bluster, Pope saw one thing clearly. However second-rate his material might be in some respects, he had here the makings of a first-class disaster, unless he could somehow restore or establish confidence in the breasts of his downhearted charges. Accordingly, as a first step before he took the field, he issued an address to the officers and soldiers of the Army of Virginia, giving them, along with much else in the way of advice, a chance to see what manner of man was about to lead them against the rebel force that had just finished mauling the first team and flinging it back from the goalpost gates of Richmond. "Let us understand each other," he told them. "I have come to you from the West, where we have always seen the backs of our enemies, from an army whose business it has been to seek the adversary and to beat him when he was found, whose policy has been attack and not defense. I presume that I have been called here to pursue the same system and to lead you against the enemy. It is my purpose to do so, and that speedily." He supposed they longed for distinction in the jar and shock of battle, and he was prepared to show them how to win it. In any event, he said, "I desire you to dismiss from your minds certain phrases which I am sorry to find so much in vogue amongst you. I hear constantly of taking strong positions and holding them, of lines of retreat and of bases of supplies. Let us discard such ideas. The strongest position a soldier should desire to occupy is one from which he can most easily advance against the enemy. Let us study the probable lines of retreat of our opponents and leave our own to take care of themselves. Let us look before us and not behind. Success and glory are in the advance. Disaster and shame lurk in the rear." The words had a Stantonian ring, which Pope explained long afterwards by identifying the secretary himself as their author. At any rate, whoever wrote them, the effect was something other than the one that had been intended, particularly among the men the undersigned general addressed. They found the comparison odious, and they resented the boasting tone in which it was made. 5-cent Pope, they dubbed their new commander, while old-time regulars recalled a parody that had made the army rounds some years ago, when he issued over-sanguine reports of success in boring for artesian water on the bone-dry plains of Texas. Pope told a flattering tale which proved to be bravado, about the streams which spout like ale on the Llano Estacado. McClellan's supporters, of course, resented him, too. Fitzjohn Porter, for example, who declared that Pope had written himself down as what the military world has long known, an ass. "If the theory he proclaims is practiced, you may look for disaster." Beyond the lines, where the address enjoyed wide circulation, the Confederate reaction combined contempt and amusement. Reports that this new spread-eagle opponent was heading his dispatches headquarters in the saddle prompted a revival of the old army jibe that he had his headquarters where his hindquarters ought to be. By the time Pope's flamboyant address was issued in mid-July, Lincoln had been down to the peninsula and back. Between the two boat rides, going and coming, He not only made a personal inspection of the Army of the Potomac and questioned its chief and subordinate generals, but he also made up his mind about a matter he had been pondering ever since his visit to Winfield Scott 3 weeks ago, a command decision involving this and all the other armies of the Union. Within 2 days of his July 1st plea for 50,000 men, with which to retrieve our fortunes after the bloodletting of the 7 days, McClellan doubled the ante. 100,000 would now be needed, he declared. Lincoln replied on the 4th that any such figure within a month or even 6 weeks is impossible. Under these circumstances, the defensive for the present must be your only care. Save the army, first where you are, if you can, secondly by removal, if you must. He added, perhaps ironically, P.S., if at any time you feel able to take the offensive, you are not restrained from doing so. Once more, he was losing patience fast. Sending troops to McClellan, he said, was like trying to shovel fleas across a barn lot. So few seemed to get there. Also, there were alarming rumors as to the condition of the men the general already had. Lincoln decided to see for himself. Boarding a steamer on the night of July 7th, he reached Harrison's Landing late the following afternoon and rode out at once with the army commander for a sundown inspection of the camps. Apparently, to his surprise, he found the men in good condition and high spirits, though the latter could be accounted for at least in part as a reaction to seeing the president on horseback. For one thing, an observer wrote home, there was the imminent danger that his long legs would become entangled with those of the horse, and both come down together. Occupied as he was in the attempt to control his mount, which seemed equally nervous, he had trouble tipping his tall hat in response to cheers that were redoubled when the difficulty was seen. That arm with which he drew the rein, in its angles and position, resembled the hind leg of a grasshopper. The hand before, the elbow away back over the horse's tail. But the boys liked him, the soldier observer added. In fact, his popularity with the army is and has been universal. Most of our rulers and leaders fall into odium, but all have faith in Lincoln. When he finds out, they say, it will be stopped. God bless the man and give answer to the prayers for guidance I am sure he offers. If guidance was what he was seeking, he could find it right there alongside him, astride Dan Webster. Less than 3 weeks ago, McClellan had requested permission to present his views on the state of military affairs throughout the country. Lincoln had replied that he would be glad to have them, preferably in a letter, he said, if their presentation would not divert too much of the general's time and attention from his immediate duties. So tonight, when they returned to headquarters, McClellan handed the president a letter covering the whole ground of our national trouble and setting forth the conditions under which he believed the struggle could be won. The rebellion, he said, had now assumed the character of a war, and, as such, it should be conducted upon the highest principles known to Christian civilization. It should not be a war looking to the subjugation of the people of any state in any event. It should not be at all a war upon population, but against armed forces and political organizations. Neither confiscation of property, political executions of persons, territorial organization of states, or forcible abolition of slavery should be contemplated for a moment. This last was a point he emphasized, since a declaration of radical views in this direction would rapidly disintegrate our present armies. More strictly within the military province, he advised concentration as the guiding rule. The national force should not be dispersed in expeditions, posts of occupation, and numerous armies, but should be mainly collected into masses and brought to bear upon the armies of the Confederate States. Those armies thoroughly defeated, the political structure which they support would soon cease to exist, and the Southern people, unembittered by depredations, would turn against the willful men who had misled them out of the Union and sue at once for peace and reentry. So he saw it. However, no matter what system of policy was adopted, he strongly urged the appointment of a general-in-chief, One who possesses your confidence, understands your views, and who is competent to execute your orders. He did not ask that post for himself, he said, but he made it clear that he would not decline the reappointment, since he was willing to serve you in such position as you may assign me, including this one. In closing, he added a final explanation and disclaimer. I may be on the brink of eternity, and as I hope forgiveness from my Maker, I have written this letter with sincerity toward you and from love for my country. Lincoln took it and read it through, with McClellan standing by. All right, he said, and put it in his pocket. That was all. Apparently he had not come down here in search of guidance. What he had come for, it developed, was a look at the present condition of the army and some specific answers to a specific question, which he put the following day to the five corps commanders. If it were desired to get the army away from here, could it be safely effected? Keyes and Franklin replied that it could and should be done. The other three thought otherwise. It would be ruinous to the country, Heintzelman said. We give up the cause if we do it, Sumner said. Move the army and ruin the country, Porter said. Once the questioning was over, Lincoln and the generals took a glass of wine together, and the president got ready to go back to Washington. McClellan was upset, particularly by the evidence that the administration might order him to evacuate the peninsula. After seeing Lincoln off next morning, he wrote his wife that he feared the president had some paltry trick up his sleeve. His manner, he said, seemed that of a man about to do something of which he was ashamed. For a week, the general brooded and delivered himself of judgments. Lincoln was an old stick, and of pretty poor timber at that, while Stanton was the most unmitigated scoundrel I ever knew, heard, or read of. He believed he saw which way the wind was blowing. Their game seems to be to withhold reinforcements and then to relieve me for not advancing, well knowing that I have not the means to do so. Accordingly, in mid-July, he wrote to his friend William H. Aspinwall, asking the New York transportation tycoon to be on the lookout for a job for him. Lincoln, meanwhile, had made up his mind to act on the command decision which he had been considering for weeks. All through the previous autumn, old General Scott had held out in Washington for as long as he could, putting up with McClellan's snubs and digs for the sake of Halleck, who was on his way from California. It was Scott's hope that old Brains would be there to take his place when he retired as General-in-Chief. But the way was long and the digs were sharp. The old man gave up before Halleck got there, and McClellan got the job. Since then, the contrast in accomplishments, east and west, seemed to reinforce Scott's original opinion, which he repeated when the president came to West Point on the eve of the 7 days. Lincoln saw merit in the recommendation, but he thought he would have a talk with Halleck before he acted on it. Back in Washington, in time for the outbreak of the 7 days, he wired the Western commander, "Please tell me, could you make me a flying visit for a consultation without endangering the service in your department?" Halleck did not want to come, and said so. "Even if he did," he added, "I could advise but one thing, to place all the Eastern forces under one head and hold that head responsible." Refusal was always provocative for Lincoln. In the course of the war, several men were to learn that the surest way to get something from him was to pretend they did not want it. He almost made up his mind then and there. Down on the peninsula, however, the matter was more or less cinched by McClellan himself. His Harrison's Landing letter, an exegesis of the conservative position, was the strongest possible proof that its author was not the kind of man to fight the kind of war Lincoln was rapidly coming to believe the country was going to have to fight if it was going to win. Returning to Washington on the night of July 10th, he had Stanton send a wire to Corinth next morning, which left the recipient no choice in the matter. Ordered that Major General Henry W. Halleck be assigned to command the whole land forces of the United States as General-in-Chief, and that he repair to this capital as soon as he can with safety to the positions and operations within the department under his charge. There were delays. Halleck did not arrive for nearly 2 weeks, being occupied with the incidentals of transferring his command. The delay was hard on Lincoln. "I am very anxious, almost impatient, to have you here," he wired. Down on the peninsula, McClellan was spared for 9 days the shock of hearing that his old post had gone to a rival. Then he read of it in a newspaper. "In all these things," he wrote his wife, "the president and those around him have acted so as to make the matter as offensive as possible. He has not shown the slightest gentlemanly or friendly feeling, and I cannot regard him as in any respect my friend. I am confident that he would relieve me tomorrow if he dared to do so. His cowardice alone prevents it. I can never regard him with other feelings than those of contempt." This was going to be a harder war from here on out, and Lincoln knew it. He knew it because he was going to make it so. In fact, he was going to make it just as hard as he had to, and he said as much, quite frankly, to anyone who asked him. Most particularly, despite conflicting advice from McClellan and men like him, it was going to be harder on civilians. Of the four actions which the general had said should not be contemplated for a moment, 1, confiscation of property, 2, political execution of persons, 3, territorial organization of states, and 4, forcible abolition of slavery, the first and second had already been carried out with governmental sanction, the third was in the legislative works, and the fourth was under urgent consideration. The second of these was the most obviously harsh, and for that reason should be the most obviously effective in securing obedience to occupation rule. So Benjamin Butler reasoned, at any rate, when he reached New Orleans and found that the national ensign, prematurely raised over the mint, had been ripped from its staff by the mob. "They have insulted our flag, torn it down with indignity," he notified the War Department. "This outrage will be punished in such manner as, in my judgment, will caution both the perpetrators and abettors of the act, so that they shall fear the stripes if they do not reverence the stars in our banner." As good as his word, Butler found a man still wearing a tatter of the outraged bunting in his buttonhole, brought him before a drumhead court, and carried out the resultant sentence by hanging him in public from a window of the building where the crime had been committed. It worked about as well as he had expected. The sight of one man dangling by his neck from the eaves of the mint sobered the others considerably. Fear, not reverence, was what Butler had wanted, and he got it, at least from the men. The women were another matter. In them he saw no signs of fear, and certainly none of reverence. In fact, they missed no chance to show their contempt for the blue-clad invaders. Passing them on the street, they drew their skirts aside to escape contamination, or else they walked straight ahead, taking their half of the sidewalk out of the middle, and forced oncoming Yankees to step off into the mud. The climax came when one of them, taking careful aim from an upstairs window, emptied a slop jar onto the head of Farragut himself. Butler retaliated with a general order, directing that hereafter, when any female shall, by word, gesture, or movement, insult or show contempt for any officer or soldier of the United States, she shall be regarded and held liable to be treated as a woman of the town plying her avocation. At home and abroad, the reaction was uproarious. Beauregard made Butler's order the subject of one of his own. "Men of the South, shall our mothers, our wives, our daughters, and our sisters be thus outraged by the ruffianly soldiers of the North, to whom is given the right to treat at their pleasure the ladies of the South as common harlots? Arouse, friends, and drive back from our soil those infamous invaders of our homes and disturbers of our family ties." Overseas, Lord Palmerston remarked, "Any Englishman must blush to think that such an act has been committed by one belonging to the Anglo-Saxon race." In Richmond, before the year was out, Davis branded Butler a felon, an outlaw, an enemy of mankind, and ordered that in the event of his capture, the officer in command of the capturing force do cause him to be immediately executed by hanging. Southerners and their blushful friends abroad were not the only ones offended by the cockeyed general's zeal. pro-Union men of the region he controlled found that they too came under his strictures, particularly in economic matters such as the seizure of cotton and the freezing of foreign funds, and they were equally vociferous in protest. But Lincoln had little use or sympathy for them. If these riders on the ship of state thought they were to touch neither a sail nor a pump, but to be merely passengers, deadheads at that, to be carried snug and dry throughout the storm and safely landed right side up, they were mistaken. He gave them a midsummer warning that the voyage was about to get rougher. "The true remedy," he said, switching metaphors, "does not lie in rounding the rough angles of the war, but in removing the necessity for war." This they could accomplish, he replied to one Protestant, by bringing Louisiana back into the Union. "Otherwise, it is for them to consider whether it is probable I will surrender the government to save them from losing all. If they decline what I suggest, you scarcely need to ask what I will do. What would you do in my position? Would you drop the war where it is? Or would you prosecute it in future with elderstalk squirts charged with rosewater? Would you deal lighter blows rather than heavier ones? Would you give up the contest, leaving any available means unapplied?" The questions were rhetorical, and he closed by answering them. "I am in no boastful mood. I shall do no more than I can, and I shall do all I can to save the government, which is my sworn duty as well as my personal inclination. I shall do nothing in malice. What I deal with is too vast for malicious dealing." Already he had sent an official observer, a Maryland senator, down to New Orleans to look into the situation. But when the senator reported that there was indeed much harshness and irregularity, Butler's brother was getting rich on confiscated cotton, and the general himself had been given the nickname Spoons, implying considerable deftness in the execution of his duties, as well as much disturbance of the master-slave relationship by the enlistment of Negroes in labor battalions, Lincoln was even more forthright in his statement of conditions and intentions. "The people of Louisiana, all intelligent people everywhere, know full well that I never had a wish to touch the foundations of their society or any right of theirs. With perfect knowledge of this, they forced a necessity upon me to send armies among them, and it is their own fault, not mine, that they are annoyed." Here again the remedy was re-entry into the Union. "And might it not be well for them to consider whether they have not already had time enough to do this? If they can conceive of anything worse within my power, would they not better be looking out for it? I am a patient man, always willing to forgive on the Christian terms of repentance. Still, I must save this government, if possible. What I cannot do, of course, I will not do, but it may as well be understood once for all that I shall not surrender this game, leaving any available card unplayed." The unplayed card was emancipation. Mindful so far of his inaugural statement, "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." Lincoln had resisted all efforts to persuade him to repudiate his words. He resisted mainly on practical grounds, considering the probable reaction in the border states. "We should lose more than we should gain," he told one Jacobin delegation. Not only had he refused to issue such a proclamation as they were urging on him, he had revoked three separate pronouncements or proclamations issued by subordinates, one by Fremont, one by Cameron, and recently a third by Hunter in South Carolina. In the instance of the latter revocation, however, he had shown which way his mind was turning in mid-May. "Whether it be competent for me as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy to declare the slaves of any state or states free, and whether at any time, in any case, it shall have become a necessity indispensable to the maintenance of the government to exercise such supposed power, are questions which, under my responsibility, I reserve to myself." This was putting a new face on the matter. What a president had no right or inclination to do in peacetime, Lincoln was saying, might become an indispensable necessity for a wartime commander-in-chief. Besides, he had done some ciphering back in March and had come up with a simple dollars and cents solution to the problem. Figuring the cost of the war at $2 million a day and the cost of slaves at $400 a head, he had found the value of Delaware's 1,798 slaves to be less than the cost of half a day of fighting. Extending his computations on this basis, he found that the total value of the 432,622 slaves in the District of Columbia and the four border states, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, amounted to less than the cost of 3 months of warfare. Accordingly, he laid these figures before Congress in support of a resolution proposing compensated emancipation. In early April, it was adopted, despite the objections of abolitionists, who considered it highly immoral to traffic thus in souls. But nothing practical came of it, because the slave state legislatures would not avail themselves of the offer. Lincoln was saddened by this failure, and on revoking Hunter's proclamation the following month, addressed a special plea to the people of the border region. "I do not argue, I beseech you, to make arguments for yourselves. You cannot, if you would, be blind to the signs of the times. I beg of you a calm and enlarged consideration of them, ranging, if it may be, far above personal and partisan politics. This proposal makes common cause for a common object, casting no reproaches upon any. It acts not the Pharisee. The change it contemplates would come gently as the dews of heaven, not rending or wrecking anything. Will you not embrace it? So much good has not been done by one effort in all past time as in the providence of God it is now your high privilege to do. May the vast future not have to lament that you have neglected it." The signs of the times were indeed plain to read. They had, in fact, the glistening clarity of wet paint, most of them having been posted about the legislative landscape during the current session of Congress. In March, subscribing to the opinion that the Dred Scott decision did not constitute law, the members fulfilled a Republican campaign promise by passing an act prohibiting slavery in all present or future national territories. The following month, the peculiar institution was abolished in the District of Columbia with compensation for the owners and provisions for colonization of the freedmen, which Lincoln considered the best practical solution to the problem. "There has never been in my mind any question upon the subject," he declared as he signed the bill, "except the one of expediency arising in view of all the circumstances. In May, the United States and Britain agreed by treaty to cooperate in suppressing the slave trade, a diplomatic move that gave much pleasure to the Jacobins, whom Lincoln had been at pains to please whenever he could. For their sake, he had proposed that the country give formal recognition to the Negro republics of Haiti and Liberia, which Congress gladly did, and back in February, despite the known leniency of his nature in such matters, he sustained the sentence of execution brought against Nathaniel Gordon of Portland, Maine, the first and only slave trader ever hanged in accordance with federal law." Gratifying as all this was, including the hanging, the Jacobins were by no means satisfied. They wanted more, much more, and they never stopped letting Lincoln know it. "The pressure in this direction is still upon me and increasing," he said on July 12th, when he called 20 border state congressmen into his office for a final appeal before next week's adjournment sent them scattering for their homes. He spoke of the continuing attempts by the seceded states to persuade their sister slave communities farther north to join them in revolt, attempts which, incidentally, if successful, would deprive these representatives of their jobs. The pull was strong, Lincoln admitted, and he wanted these men to help him weaken it. "You and I know what the lever of their power is. Break that lever before their faces, and they can shake you no more forever." Besides, he said, slavery was failing fast already. "If the war continues long, the institution in your states will be extinguished by mere friction and abrasion. How much better for you and for your people to take the step which at once shortens the war and secures substantial compensation for that which is sure to be wholly lost in any other event." They heard him out, and then they shook their heads. The adopted resolution not only seemed to them a violation of state rights, but they also questioned the constitutional power of Congress to appropriate funds for such a purpose. What was more, they doubted the sincerity of their fellow congressmen. The offer, one of the callers said, was but the enunciation of a sentiment which could not or was not likely to be reduced to an actual tangible proposition. If Congress really meant it, let the money be put in the president's hands, and then they would consider acceptance. Then, too, though this objection went unspoken, the plan entailed payment in government bonds, and though slave property was admittedly precarious and declining fast in value, the national credit was declining even faster. In short, they wanted no part of the offer as things now stood. Respectfully, they bowed and took their leave, and Lincoln was left saddened and alone. Left alone, he would act alone. He knew well enough the arguments against what McClellan, 4 days before, had called a declaration of radical views on the slavery issue. Possible loss of the border states, possible loss of large segments of the army through desertion, possible loss of the fall elections. He knew, too, of currents that ran deeper, of Archbishop John Hughes of New York, for example, who had warned in a widely reprinted official declaration, "We, Catholics, and a vast majority of our brave troops in the field, have not the slightest idea of carrying on a war that costs so much blood and treasure just to gratify a clique of abolitionists in the North." A Westerner, Lincoln knew the rabid division on the subject in the West, where candidates were tagged charcoal and snowflake in anger and derision, regardless of party. Such considerations, the concrete along with the nebulous, had weight. But he also knew the arguments in favor of positive action. First, it would allay the danger of foreign intervention by engaging the sympathy and arousing the enthusiasm of the rank and file of Europe, against which not even the most avid of the pro-Confederate rulers and ministers would dare to act. Second, whatever it did to the Democrats here at home, it would heal the split in his own party, which was rapidly getting out of hand. Beyond, if not above, all these, and entirely aside from his promises to those who claimed to have removed themselves from his authority, there was the question of personal ethics, of whether the considered step was consonant with honor. He had called the nation to arms in support of a single issue, the preservation of the Union. Could he now adopt a second, superimpose it, so to speak, without being guilty of chicanery or worse? He believed he could, and he based his persuasion on necessity. "Things had gone on from bad to worse," he later explained, "until I felt that we had reached the end of our rope on the plan of operations we had been pursuing, that we had about played our last card and must change our tactics or lose the game." The truth was, the war had already outlasted the heady burst of enthusiasm that had flared up after Sumter. What was needed was a new cause, not to supplant, but to supplement the old. And this was it. Having appealed at the outset to reason, he now would appeal to conscience. He would translate the conflict into the terms of a holy war, a crusade, for which Julia Ward Howe had already composed the anthem. "In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on." Before the night was over, though the details were still to be worked out, he had completed his decision. He would do it. And next afternoon, much to their surprise, since always before, as one of them said, he had been prompt and emphatic in denouncing any interference by the general government with the subject, he spoke of it to two members of his cabinet. The occasion was a funeral. The Stantons had lost a newborn child, and Lincoln rode to the burial in a carriage with Wells and Seward. According to Wells, the president dwelt earnestly on the gravity, importance, and delicacy of the slavery question, and the advisability of issuing an emancipation proclamation, in case the rebels did not cease to persist in their war on the government, of which he saw no evidence. He said he had about come to the conclusion that it was a military necessity absolutely essential for the salvation of the Union, that we must free the slaves or be ourselves subdued. Asked for their opinions on the matter, both men were at first too taken aback by what Wells called this new departure to say anything at all. Seward, recovering first, replied that his present opinion inclined to the measure as justifiable, but he would rather think the matter through before giving a final answer. Wells said he felt the same way about it. Lincoln let it go at that, though he made it clear that he was earnest in the conviction that something must be done. 4 days later, July 17th, Congress came very close to stealing his thunder. In August of the previous year, this body had passed a Confiscation Act, endorsing Butler's contention that the slaves of disloyal masters were contraband, liable to seizure and eligible for freedom on entering Union lines. Now, in the final hours before adjournment of the current session, a second such act was passed. Considerably sharper-toothed than the one that had gone before, it provided that every person who shall hereafter commit the crime of treason against the United States, and shall be adjudged guilty thereof, shall suffer death, and all his slaves, if any, shall be declared and made free. Discretion was left to the courts as to whether a prison term and/or a fine should be substituted in lieu of the death penalty, but no leeway was allowed as to the disposition of a traitor's slaves, who were automatically freed upon his conviction. At first glance, with nearly the whole slave region in rebellion, this appeared to be the very proclamation Lincoln was considering. However, closer reading showed it to be no such thing. No slave was to be freed by it until his master had been convicted of treason in a federal court. There was the rub. Secession, or rebellion, as the Jacobins preferred to call it, might be treason, but no court had ever said so, or ever would say so, no matter what opinion the radicals had on the matter. All the acts really did was provide a sanctuary for such slaves as crossed the federal lines, with the result that the U.S. government became, in effect, the greatest slaveholder the world had ever known, not excepting the pharaohs of Egypt. Lincoln doubted the legality of the act. "It is startling to say that Congress can free a slave within a state," he declared in a veto message which he had prepared against its passage. All the same, he signed it as soon as it reached his desk, but in doing so he forwarded the proposed veto message in order to make his objections part of the record when the legislation was tested in the courts. Read in both houses as a prelude to adjournment, the message was greeted with sneers and laughter by the radicals, who took it as an admission that, when the chips were down, he did not dare to oppose them with anything but words. In this they were much mistaken, though words were very much a part of what he had in mind. On July 22nd, to the surprise of all but Wells and Seward, who had been prepared for something of the sort by his remarks in the funeral carriage 9 days back, he read to the assembled cabinet an Emancipation Proclamation, which he proposed to issue without delay. Unlike the Confiscation Act, which required that individuals be convicted of treason before their slaves were freed, Lincoln's edict left no burden of proof upon the government. He intended it as a military pronouncement, designed to help win the war, and that was all. He was not concerned with legality as such, since he did not deal with individuals as such. All he required was that they live within an area where the authorities, after a specified date, continued to defy the federal government. The object of the war, he repeated, was the preservation of the Union. And as a fit and necessary military measure for effecting this object, I, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States, do order and declare that on the first day of January in the year of our Lord 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or states wherein the constituted authority of the United States shall not then be practically recognized, submitted to, and maintained, shall then thenceforward and forever be free. Reactions varied. Chase and Stanton approved, but wanted it stronger. Bates wanted it as it was. Wells wanted it weaker. Blair and Smith did not want it at all, or at least not before the fall elections. Then Seward spoke, having turned the matter over in his mind. "Mr. President," he said, "I approve of the proclamation, but I question the expediency of its issue at this juncture. The depression of the public mind, consequent upon our repeated reverses, is so great that I fear the effect of so important a step. It may be viewed as the last measure of an exhausted government, a cry for help, the government stretching forth its hands to Ethiopia instead of Ethiopia stretching forth her hands to the government. It will be considered our last shriek on the retreat. Now, while I approve the measure, I suggest, sir, that you postpone its issue until you can give it to the country supported by military success, instead of issuing it, as would be the case now, upon the greatest disasters of the war. Lincoln had not considered this aspect of the question, but now that he did so, he perceived its wisdom and acted in accord with Seward's view. "I put the draft of the proclamation aside," he later told an artist friend, "as you do your sketch for a picture, waiting for a victory." Halleck, the man he counted on to give him one, was on the way at last, would arrive, in fact, tomorrow. Meanwhile, this thunderbolt would keep. 2. There was gloom in the West, as in the East, but it was of a different nature, proceeding from different causes. Here, too, the advance had stalled, yet it was precisely in this apparent similarity that the difference obtained. McClellan had been stopped by Lee, but Halleck stopped himself. Curiously enough, or perhaps not curiously at all, the men on the peninsula who had fought and fallen back, fighting as they went, had developed a fierce pride that burned brighter at the end of their retreat than it had ever burned before. They had fought well, and they knew it. Whereas Halleck's soldiers felt less elation at the end of their burrowing advance than at the start, not having fought at all. That was the source of a different kind of gloom. Sherman did not share it, still being happy with the new stars on his shoulders and the sense of having found himself in the ordeal of Shiloh. But when he called by Army headquarters not long after the fall of Corinth, he heard something that caused him to suspect that his friend Grant was in lower spirits than ever. Halleck happened to remark that Grant had applied for a 30-day leave. He was going away next morning. Halleck said he did not know why, but Sherman took it to mean that Grant, chafing under the slights, intended this as a first step in submitting his resignation. Determined to stop him if he could, Sherman rode over and found him sitting in his tent, sorting some letters and tying them into bundles with red tape. Grant said it was true that he was leaving, and when the red-headed general asked him why, he replied, "Sherman, you know I am in the way here. I have stood it as long as I can and can endure it no longer." Where was he going? "St. Louis," Grant said. "Did he have any business there?" "Not a bit," Grant said. So Sherman, being then in what he called high feather, began to argue with him, illustrating Grant's case with his own. "Look at him," he said. They had called him crazy as a loon, but he had hung on through Shiloh, and that single battle had given me new life. Besides, if Grant went away, events would go right along and he would be left out, whereas if he remained, some happy accident might restore him to favor and his true place. This had its effect. Grant promised to wait, or at any rate not to leave, without seeing Sherman again or sending him word. Satisfied, Sherman left, and before the week was out received a note from Grant. He had reconsidered. He would stay. Sherman replied that he was glad to hear it, for you could not be quiet at home for a week when armies were moving. Armies were moving now, though not in the direction of the Confederates who had fallen back before them. Like a man riding an oversized, mettlesome horse, which he feared might take the bit in its teeth and bolt off with him any minute, Halleck kept as close a rein as possible on his 120,000-man army. Even so, the advance had already covered more ground than he had intended. Once he had accomplished what he set out for, in particular, control of a sizable stretch of the Memphis and Charleston Railroad, he was more than ready to call a halt and consolidate his gains. 4 days after the occupation of Corinth, he warned the commander of the pursuit against goading the rebels into rashness. All he wanted, he said, was for them to fall back far enough to be beyond reach of the railroad. And he added, "There is no object in bringing on a battle if this object can be obtained without one. I think by showing a bold front for a day or two, the enemy will continue his retreat, which is all that I desire." Having withheld his army from pursuit, he now proceeded to dismember it. Eastward, westward, even northward, he dispersed it, every way, in fact, but southward. On June 9th, he instructed Pope, who presently was on his way to Washington, superseded by Rosecrans, to draw back closer to Corinth and take up outpost positions to defend it. And that same day the scattering began, a scattering that divided the Grand Army into four main parts, rather as if the aforementioned timid rider had decided not only to get rid of his mettlesome horse, but to do so by having it drawn and quartered. Buell was ordered east with four divisions to make connection with Ormsby Mitchell, who had encountered so much difficulty in North Alabama. His goal was Chattanooga, which would put him within possible reach of Knoxville or Atlanta. Sherman was sent west. He would garrison Memphis with two divisions, repairing the railroad on the way and doing what he could to restore the wrecked economy by assuring all country people that they will be permitted to take their cotton freely to market, and that the ordinary channels of trade will be immediately reopened. McClernand, with a similar force, was given a similar mission, except that his destination lay 50 miles north at Jackson, Tennessee. He, too, was to repair the lines of supply and give the country people whatever assurance was needed to make them happy. Halleck himself would remain with the force at Corinth, coordinating the efforts of the other three. His main concern in ordering the dispersal, he told Stanton, was the sanitary condition of the men. At present it was good, he said, but the question arose, can it be kept so during the summer?